So I'm going to be shifting gears again, and my colleagues here presented, Hal presented on a high-level federal approach to implementing behavioral care into practice. Alana spoke about a systems-wide approach. What I'm going to be addressing is how we're going to meet the needs that providers identify in order to bridge that gap at the patient level. How do we meet their expressed needs? So, and before I go on, I also want to acknowledge the contributions of Jane Lowers, who worked with us as the senior scientific advisor from Medscape Education, which was one of our partners on working on this project. And for those of you who aren't familiar with IQ Solutions, we provide broad-based health communications and web strategies to our clients, and we work extensively with various branches of the National Institutes of Health, SAMHSA, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and a number of other federal organizations. I have nothing to disclose. I also want to mention that this project itself was part of the NIDAMED portfolio of medical education resources, and specifically this project was supported through the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. And finally, I'm going to put up front, I want to acknowledge the contributions of all of our team members, the IQ team, especially Vera Nordholm, who is here today, who is our amazing project manager, our Medscape team, including Jane Lowers, and of course our NIDA team, headed by Carol Krause, who was is our contract officer. So as a means of kind of contextualizing why this program came to be, I'm just going to give you a brief review. Some of this was touched on in some of the other ATOD sessions, but sort of the state of the science in understanding the prescription drug abuse and specifically opioid abuse epidemic in the U.S. So as of 2010, we noted that over a million ER visits annually are related to prescription drug abuse, and this is more than half of the drug-related ER visits noted. Accidental deaths involving opioid pain relievers have increased fourfold in the decade between 1999 and 2008. And these deaths now outnumber all other drug-related deaths. We also have noted that in the past 20 years, not surprisingly, when we see this increase in ER visits, we've also seen an increase in opioid prescriptions of fourfold. And this is especially of note because estimates currently run in the area of more than 100 million people living with chronic pain and being treated with opioids in the U.S. And although it's kind of a moving target, we've noted that between 3% and 26% of those folks may actually be abusing. And one last point that I think is very germane to this particular issue in this project is that when we looked at opioid abusers in the last year, fully almost 20% of them actually received their opioid from one physician. The reason this is significant is that it demonstrates that these are not the so-called frequent flyers. They're not going in and falsifying documents. They're not doctor shopping. They're actually getting it for a profound need in the clinical setting, and there's something being missed by their primary care provider. So this is really the goal of what these this program is going to be. As means of a project overview, in 2009, NIDA launched, the National Institute on Drug Abuse launched its NIDAMED website, which is now currently managed and maintained by IQ Solutions. And this was meant to be a repository for all of their various curricula and resources and screening tools. But in many ways, it's a great repository, but it's a hodgepodge of, there's PDFs, there's Word documents, there's actual screening tools, links to other tools. And they really wanted to pull all of this material together in a user-friendly and innovative continuing education course that could be self-administered and that folks could use on the fly, on a mobile device, or at their desktop. So that was what our charge was when we began. Some specific objectives were to develop two continuing medical education programs, each delivering 1.25 credit hours, contact hours. In point of fact, when we launched, one of them was actually 1.25 and one was 1.75. And we only recently launched, the Medscape launch was September 27th, and our NIDA launch, which I'll talk about, it's kind of a parallel launch, was on October 25th. We also wanted to make sure that these modules were available in a mobile format. We wanted to engage at least two medical schools to reach a total of 200 medical students by integrating these materials into existing medical school curricula. In point of fact, we've actually been able to partner with three medical schools, the University of Washington, the University of Florida, and the University of Utah. Our basic goal was to reach a minimum of 5,000 practicing physicians. Now, the nursey nurse in me railed against that, but this is what we were funded to do. We, through some very careful planning and a lot of budget crunching on Vera's part, we were able to actually, and with the endorsement of NIDA, which is very committed to nursing, we were actually able to expand the program to address continuing nursing education credits. And as you'll see when I talk a little bit about the live launch, that has been a tremendously successful effort. Finally, and of course, last but not least, we aim to conduct an evaluation that looks not only at the usability and functionality of the program, but also immediate knowledge change and perhaps potential to change practice in the future. The way we designed the project was around three basic tasks. The first being the development of the CME modules, the second being the recruitment and distribution of the modules, and the third being evaluation. Now, this is a two-year plan, a two-year contract. The first year is really focused primarily on the development and launch of the modules. But of course, the marketing begins on day one, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, as well as the evaluation planning. But a lot of the evaluation planning couldn't really begin until we had actually launched the project because of some of the web strategies that need to be implemented into evaluation plans. So first, in terms of task number one, the module development, this was kind of phased in three distinct phases and over the course of a year. And I might mention that the reason this was a successful project, and I feel very strongly that it is successful, is that we were very conscious of the iterative nature of working with a federal partner. NIDA, we were working very specifically with the Communications Outreach Branch. So they are very much about the details. If we had ignored this part of their contribution, it would have been a disaster on launch day. And we would have been backtracking and correcting. But because we were iterative throughout the process, we were able to launch with a smooth product, an excellent product that was agreed upon by all the parties to be the best we could produce. So the first phase of that CME development was a discovery phase, where we looked at what was needed and what we had and what we could adapt. The second phase was the content and the experience design, where we actually worked on designing the website. And finally, it was the development of the modules themselves, and then launching the modules just recently within the last month. Okay, so looking specifically at the discovery phase, we took a three-pronged approach to this. The first thing was that we utilized findings from a Medscape survey, and they do a number of these surveys throughout the year. Very specifically, this was looking at prescribing patterns among physicians across a wide range of specialties. We also conducted in-depth interviews with four academic medical school educators who were also clinical experts in pain and addiction treatment. And these folks came from the three universities that we had established partnerships with. And finally, we embarked on a very comprehensive review and content analysis of all of the materials that currently were residing on the NIDA website. So we wanted to look at references. Were they current? Were they up to date? Did we have the best references available? but also how could we use these materials to create these new modules? What could we draw from them? Could we use them for didactic portions? Could they inform script development for our video vignettes? So we looked very carefully at that. And again, this was an iterative process. Every step of the way, it was back and forth between IQ, Medscape, and our NIDA partners. So in terms of the audience needs survey, which we was called a taken as prescribed survey, we had about 740 participants in approximately a 2.5-week program. The specialties that were most likely, that were identified as the highest number of participants were emergency medicine, anesthesiology, and family medicine, with OBGYN and other disciplines coming in close seconds. What we, the interesting thing was that these specialties mirrored the findings reported by Dr. Nora Volkow in a paper last year of who was prescribing opioids. So that was nice to see that the folks who actually are prescribing were very interested in participating in this survey. And when we looked at some of the characteristics of this group, we found that approximately 93% of them were actually prescribing opiates. However, only 67% of those folks were screening for prescription drug abuse. They were screening very actively for tobacco, alcohol, and illicit drug use, but didn't seem to see prescription drug abuse as a problem until it sort of reared its ugly head in the clinical setting, as we see in the 47% screening as needed. So then we embarked on the in-depth interviews with our experts. They confirmed a lot of what we had found in the survey in terms of potential audiences who could benefit from the CME. They also identified nursing and nursing practitioners. They identified medical school educators and students, as well as mid-level providers such as physician assistants, social workers, dentists. The other thing that they identified was that one of the major, most widely used NIDA screening tools, the NM Assist, was quite effective. And some of them said it was the best of what's out there for a quick screen to really do that S of the S-BERT. But they did identify gaps in the materials that were there, namely communications. How do we talk to our clients about that? How do we start the conversation? How do we do this in a non-judgmental manner and get it done in 1 to 2 minutes? They also mentioned that there was no available information on drug disposal or drug diversion, which is where drugs prescribed for one person are actually used and misused by another person. And finally, the content analysis portion of the review. We looked at all the references as well as the relevance to utilizing these in developing the CME modules. So now we turned our attention to the module development. And this is where we relied most heavily on Medscape, which worked as a subcontractor with us and is widely renowned for its expertise in continuing medical education programming. They, in conjunction with us and our partners at NIDA, we decided to use what is termed a test-and-teach approach. This has been identified as one of their most successful approaches because it's multimodal, which is good for adult learners, and it's good for clinicians who want not only the didactic materials, but they want it presented in a real-world case format, and they want to see how it looks in practice. You know, give me some best practice examples to follow. This has been proven to be a successful approach, and so this was the approach we engaged in. So part of this was that during the development process, we needed to develop not only scripts and materials for the modules, but also scripts for video vignettes, and we also had to do casting calls, and we had to go through the whole issue of video production. Just a brief overview of the two modules. The first one is called Safe Prescribing for Pain, and this is kind of a basic primer on how to address the issue of screening for potential for opioid abuse in a new patient who is about to be prescribed opiates. to look at the potential for abuse in terms of the prevailing context of the United States in terms of abuse, and also to talk a little bit about best practices for providers who are initiating opiate therapy. The second module is called Managing Pain Patients Who Abuse Prescription Drugs. So this is looking more at the chronic pain patient who the practitioner suspects may be entering an abusive cycle, or maybe at a very high risk, a higher risk than they had been in the past, for abusing opiates. And what I'd like to do now is this is a screenshot of the second module. I'm always leery of using Wi-Fi in a hotel conference center, so I opted for the less perfect approach of doing a screenshot. But this just shows you that when we introduce the case, we include an initial case presentation, and then we ask a question to sort of gauge where providers are in terms of their knowledge base. These questions are then reiterated at the end as a post-test. And then the provider gives their answer, they go to the next page, and they see not only the correct answer and the rationale, but they see how their colleagues voted in terms of polling feedback. More didactic information is introduced and more case information, and then we get to a video vignette which illustrates a best practice. And each of these modules contains 3 to 4 vignettes. So I'm going to try to, let's see. It worked in practice. There we go. There we go.
Ask me whatever questions you want.
Answer each question based on a 5-point opinion according to how often you have used each substance over the past year. Never, once or twice, monthly, weekly, daily, or on the
okay.
On average, how often did you drink alcohol beverages over the past year? Never, once or twice, monthly, weekly, daily, or on the
well, if you count wine or beer during dinner, I'd have to say almost every day.
And how many drinks did you typically have each day?
Oh, one or two.
How often have you used tobacco products over the past year? Never, once, twice, monthly, weekly, daily, or almost daily?
Mm. Well, I quit smoking 12 years ago when I got married, but don't tell my wife. I occasionally sneak a cigarette or two when I'm out with my friends. Maybe once a month.
Have you used any prescription drugs over the past?
So I'm going to stop it there. I'm sure you all noticed at the very end of that very short clip that the provider was looking at an iPad. We were very conscious about demonstrating how to incorporate the mobile version of the screening tool into clinical practice. This patient, this was the second case, he gets a lot angrier. Which you see, somebody said, it was kind of gripping, like an episode of Dynasty or something, but he wants his drugs. These are some photos, just some photos to illustrate what the drug screening tool that looks like in an iPad version and a greatly enhanced, enlarged iPhone. I guess this might be iPhone 6, where it's actually equivalent size. But it is a very quick response. The provider keys in the 5 questions and then gets a probability result of whether or not the patient may be at risk. So having talked about the module development themselves, I want to turn my attention now to looking at recruitment and distribution, which, as I mentioned before, started on day one of the project. We wanted to get a minimum of 5,000 practicing physicians. We were able to expand that to nursing, and we were able to partner with 3 medical schools rather than 2 medical schools. Now, incorporating these modules into the medical school curricula will be occurring in this second year of the project. Okay. We did a very extensive environmental scan for marketing and distribution purposes. Just a few of the highlights are that physicians and other providers rely on the internet to get their information. They want to get CME over the internet. They would like to receive information on substance use. We also were able to identify that there are a number of states which require physicians to complete CME courses in pain management to satisfy licensure requirements. Oh, gosh. Okay. Jeez. Okay. So in terms of dissemination distribution, this is just a graphical representation to highlight how we were able to leverage existing and new partners to create partnerships, to build those partnerships, and then to phase in the marketing over the two-year period. Now, phase one, as I said, began sort of, it really kicked in midway through the first year. We're in the middle of that now, and that uses both Medscape approaches to marketing the modules, but also NIDA approaches and things that we're doing through IQ in terms of email blasts, medical school outreach. About 6 months into the second year, we're going to kick into phase two to kind of give the program a bump. And throughout it all, evaluation. How effective is this? What kind of response are we getting to each of the approaches? This is really where partnerships come into play here. It's a given that we're partnering with a federal organization. We're a private company, and then there's Medscape, which is an education company. So that's a partnership into itself. But in order to get the word out about this educational opportunity, we've relied on a number of partnerships that we've been building and we continue to work on, including existing NIH partnerships, physician social networks, state physician and medical and nursing associations, state prescription monitoring programs, medical, nursing, and other healthcare profession schools, as well as bloggers and email listservs. This is just an example of a Save the Date art card, which we designed to promote this at the Prescription Drug Abuse Summit. We used a QRS code so that we could get information to provide, to send out announcements as this was getting ready to go live. This is an ad that we recently did for the NIDA resources booklet. It was a very quick turnaround, maybe what, 3-4 days, if that. And part of that is they wanted a logo. It's like, oh, okay. So we developed the eNIDA logo for that which the client is extremely pleased with, and it's now branding all of these products. What is it, 1 minute? 2 minutes, okay. So finally, turning my attention to evaluation, as I mentioned before, we want to look at the utilization of the modules as well as the satisfaction and knowledge diffusion. Obviously, because we just launched this evaluation project, part of the process is begins on day one. So we'll be running our first report sometime in early December. But basically, we're looking at parallel data points, both gathered from the Medscape site, but also gathered from the NIDA Med site. These modules, which I may not have made clear earlier, will reside on both Medscape, where they are given for credit, but also on the NIDA site where they can be explored without credit for folks who aren't interested in getting credit. And what happened, I'll give you the URL shortly, where you can go to the NIDA Med site and you're given the option to go to get credits or to just move through them and explore them. Some people like to do that before they go for credits. These non-accreditive modules will be also what we incorporate into the medical school curricula. Just a quick mention of our performance indicators for evaluation. In addition to the 5,000 physicians and medical schools and medical students, we also are aiming to get 1.7 million touch points on the NIDA Med website, as well as to increase traffic to the NIDA Med website. And this is a key part because by increasing traffic to that website, not only are we getting people to the modules, but we're getting people to the broader range of services and resources that NIDA offers. So here's the very exciting part. We launched live on Medscape on September 26th. On October 25th, we went live with the unaccredited versions on the NIDA website. Within the first week of going live, we had more than 10,000 folks who actually completed the two modules, and quite impressive. As of October 24th, we have more than 20,000 completers, including approximately 7,000 MDs who have completed. So we've already met our minimum goal of 5,000. But also a great number of nurses and nurse practitioners. So this is very heartening in terms of when we look at future projects and future outreach for other things related to prescription drug abuse, it's clear that this is something that is very popular for nursing and nursing providers. So the next steps of the project, as we have moved into year two, is that we're looking at integrating into the medical school curricula, continuing to extend that recruitment and distribution to reach even a broader range of providers, and to continue to do ongoing evaluation and reporting. So in summary, I just wanted to pull out some of the most salient points. Prevention and identifying opioid abuse, while at the same time providing adequately for pain relief, is a real challenge in the clinical setting. NIDA provides many resources which can help meet this challenge. And through developing these CMEs, they've really brought these resources together in a very innovative and useful manner. And finally, partnering is key, whether it's partnering with our federal partners across multiple branches of NIH, or if it's partnering with state associations, professional associations, or civic and private entities, even as far down the food chain as an individual blogger who may be very well respected for their input. So with that, I want to show you the website. Got a little mushed in there, but if you go to the drugabuse.gov/NIDAMED/e-tools, you will hit a landing page where you can choose whether you go to the Medscape site. And if you're not registered at Medscape, it's very easy to register. Wide range of disciplines can register. There's no cost, and I should have mentioned that at the beginning. These are at no cost, the credit hours, which is kind of a rare bird nowadays. Yeah. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Aaron.
Thank you. Before people start leaving, I also want to recognize Kathy Gorosh, who put together our resource list, and Linda Frazier. Kathy, please stand up. And Linda Frazier, who's our program chair, who made this session successful, and Linda is the person you want to talk to if you want to participate in the program next year. I also want to thank all our presenters and ask them to come to the podium to take questions. All right. Good participation. Yes. Thank you.
The other thing is, I would say that in Esper work I've done in New England, the consistent theme is from physicians, we were never trained in medical school. We don't, and by and large, that's true. I think it's great to integrate in medical school because physicians often don't have the training expertise to engage in conversations. And I don't understand why we insist that physicians are the only ones to do that. So nursing, other folks who are behavioral health providers, do a very good job. The other point for Esper, I think with the workflow is a huge issue. If people say, look, what happens when someone's screened positive and we can't deal with them for 2 hours and we have a whole waiting room of patients, and who's going to pay us for it? So now there are codes that have been approved, Medicaid, many states have activated Medicaid codes, but almost no state has really robust reimbursement. Part of it, I think, is because I don't think we've really done a good job at focusing on workflow. The fact that the first presentation is one of eight behavioral health services with FQHCs, that's to me absurd. How do we expect FQHCs and other primary care providers to provide behavioral health when they flat out don't get reimbursed, when we don't provide the infrastructure support and the business model that we expect, the sort of Blue Cross and the larger HMOs that use that. So I'm kind of interested to know what Kaiser, if you actually pay for it.
So because there's many questions, I'm going to first go to Robert, and then go to Alana to speak to the issues of training around prescription drugs and those that are not included, and then about workflow.
Thank you for making the point about who can actually deliver these interventions. Advanced practice nurses, nurse practitioners, are trained in therapeutic communication pretty much across all of our programming. And we're very well placed, whether we're frontline RNs or advanced practice nurses, to administer these. I think as we see continued implementation of the Affordable Care Act, that there are going to be more opportunities for nurses to take up some of those charges and really be a more active leadership role in the care team. So I think that's a very good point.
Alana?
And like I would say, you saw, we are looking at using other providers, the behavioral medicine specialists, for delivering part of the ESPRT process. Kaiser is, in being both the insurer and the provider of care, previously we hadn't worried so much about the billing codes and all of that, but however, now that, especially in Colorado, we are starting to offer different, in order to compete in that environment, we have to offer different health plans. We now have PPOs and other type of health plans that are offered. That is something we are starting to look at, is the reimbursement process and how that works. We're just at the very beginning of that. So I can't really offer too much on that, but we are starting to look at it.
And Hal, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, and it is true that the reimbursement models here are very bad as far as trying to reimburse for behavioral health care services in the primary care setting. Hopefully, you know, as through the Affordable Care Act, with the health homes and with the accountable care organizations, we move a little bit more towards managed care, that will, you know, people, organizations will be paid for providing the comprehensive care and making a patient well. So that'll maybe account for that a little bit. But it was interesting because when I hear clinics talk about it, our clinics are really dedicated, or some of our clinics are very dedicated to the idea that behavioral health care is important to provide in that primary care setting. For a lot of people, that's the only chance that you're going to get to really access these people. And so the way they kind of view it is, and the way it kind of came to me is they're almost, it's the drug dealer model, where when you get them in the door, you get them into your ESPRT screening, or the first interaction that they can get with a behavioral health provider, and that first interaction is free. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to be able to bill for it because the same day billing in 14 plus 3 states, or because of the different billing codes and such. But the idea is that you give them that free service a little bit, try to hook them a little bit, and then maybe later on down the line, you can convince them that they need to be coming in for more comprehensive care, and then that is something that you can bill for.
Thank you. Woman in purple.
For Hal, a community health center, is that the same as FQHC?
It is not. No, there's a lot of crazy terminology out there.
So who administers FQHC?
FQHC is a CMS term, and you have to meet certain requirements in order to be an FQHC. All community health centers are FQHCs, but not all FQHCs are community health centers.
Okay.
Because the community health centers.
Yeah. The
phrase that I actually like a little bit better, because it's not as generic, is Section 330 funded community health center. Those are the ones that receive the HRSA grants to try to compensate for the unreimbursed care.
Thank you. And the woman in the plaid shirt, and then the woman in back who was standing. Would you stand, please, so we can...
They must have experience with ESPRT reimbursement in mm-hmm. our state. It's $7 for 10 minutes of doctor
right.
only time. That's ridiculous. But my concern is a different concern as we move forward. For many of us who work in addictions, we're dealing with a population that's highly stigmatized.
Yes.
I'm particularly concerned about CME modules that have a component, and I feel like, you know... the NIDAMED that we work with, I'm from Boston, has mostly come out of the U.S., somewhat clumsy, that contribute to what, in particularly the high-prescribing emergency medicine and anesthesiology departments, tend to be a gotcha mentality. We're not going to be tricked, so we're not going to give you pain meds. And so I'm very worried about, it coming from our experience with HIV, how are we going to address stigma and not creating novel stigma toward patients who look like abusers.
Robert, you want to speak to that?
Yes, that's a great point. And we address stigmatization and the underpinning of all discussion of communication revolves around non-judgmental and normalizing. I share your concerns because I've worked directly with HIV and substance use for the best part of my career. So that's been a commitment of us. We also, even to the point of casting, we were very careful to try and do a broad range of gender and racial representation, which of course, even with the best intentions, some folks said, well, you shouldn't have used this, you shouldn't. But it is a good point. Our goal really is to bring that stigmatization down and to make providers less concerned and really incorporate this as a normalized part of their practice. Obviously, that is a challenge. Anybody who's worked in substance abuse and HIV knows that there's a wide gap between theory and practice. But we were very conscious of this through all members of our team are very committed to not only being conscious of cultural diversity, but also cultural stereotypes. And I think you'll find that there's a good measure of promoting non-judgmental approaches to intervention. The flip side to that challenge, and I've encountered this in my HIV work, is that the most well-meaning providers in some of the most distinguished HIV care settings are resistant to do the screening, to ask the questions, because they don't want to further stigmatize the client. So that's a real tension, a real dilemma, in that you've got folks who want to provide the care and services, but they don't want to further push the client further away and make them feel like they've been singled out. So the idea is to really use a multidisciplinary approach that normalizes these types of interventions across all branches. I mean, that's my personal view, is that it should be a non-judgmentalism that starts with the receptionist and the scheduler, goes through the intake nurse or nurse practitioner, and extends to the behavioral health specialist and the physician, so that everybody's on the same page in terms of presenting this in a normalized fashion.
And the last question, please stand up. Yes.
I need to make a disclaimer that I'm not a physician or a clinical person. I'm a community-based organization. And we have piloted a lot of partnerships with the clinical community. And I'm particularly interested in the SBRIT model, because one of the things we have tried to get mainstream is perinatal depression screening and treatment. And we managed to get a city hospital to do something that is very close to what was described in SBRIT. The challenge has been that a practitioner that is a maternal child health and psychiatry trained was loaned from the behavioral health into the primary care clinic to try this model out, but couldn't sustain it because of the same issues that was raised for us with payment. You know, they were paying her out of psychiatry. But
so your question, please,
so
and
question
to whom?
Is, the question is, with the expert model in the interest of course or SAMHSA to afford that, what is the likelihood that a community-based organization, not a medical provider, can work with a hospital or clinic setting to really pilot that, and is that likely to be funded? Because that's the big question for sustainability.
Ken, does it make sense to have Hal give his insight from the federal side? And the speakers for the next session are here, so Hal, quickly.
So I assume that with SBRIT, you're talking about initially the patients are coming into a community health clinic.
The patient are coming into a hospital OBGYN setting.
Okay.
The mainstream is perinatal depression. A mainstream education.
Yeah. So as far as the HRSA clinics go, I mean, they welcome referrals from outside sources, and all HRSA clinics are expected to have a referral relationship with their local hospitals. And so it's just a matter of establishing communication lines there. As opposed to how SBRIT would act starting at the hospital, maybe you can address that.
Yeah,
I actually don't know how, other than to try to find connections to SAMHSA and approach them. I don't know what the answer to your question is of how SAMHSA would fund that. You'd have to look directly to SAMHSA.
Yeah, we have to. I'm sorry. We have to make this a private conversation because our speakers are here. Yes. Move to the side. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for coming and join us this evening.